Hi, and welcome back to the Liam Chef Show, Truth Frequency Radio, UCY TV. Are we a monogamous species? Let's look around the world. You have the South Pacific, you have South America, you have Africa, very, very large, you have India, you have the Centrals, Central America, Central Asia, Europe, North Africa, the Middle East, much of China, Japan, did I say North America? This long stretch of North America, Mesoamerica, that's central. You have North, colder and colder. You have, let's think about what we have there. We have clans and tribes. We have civilizations occurring more in the North, where there is winter. In the heavy tropics, we don't get as much civilization. We have more tribal life. It's kind of too hot to do much. You don't have to invent things to protect you from the cold, so you don't really get a civilization as much as you get tribal life. You get a lot of rituals. You get a lot of customs. Customs are a way of memorizing without having history books. You remember the recent past. You remember episodes and events, but you don't have to write them down. Custom is slowly transferred into something like ritual. So if you have a custom to protect yourself from mosquitoes by packing mud on you, it's eventually ritualized in some religious memory. And you imagine that you have a religious predecessor, a mythic predecessor who used the sacred mud of the sacred lake to protect against the villainous mosquito. And you have stories about the villainous mosquito and how to protect. And that's how you remember things. You enshrine them in myth. Now, are any of these people monogamous? No. No, of course not. Monogamy, when we talk about monogamy, what we really mean is economics. And this is a tough one for people to understand, because our culture has so enshrined a myth of monogamy, a Hallmark card, that's been transmuted into the New Age myth of two souls alighting with each other through all of life's adventures. Well, it's 20 kinds of, you know, Susan Poleschutz bullshit, New Age card bullshit. Two souls don't travel together all lifelong, you know, learning and learning and learning, and also bind each other with promises. One, you know, you can always check in with your person who you're traveling and checking in with life. You know, I'm traveling through life and I'm checking in with you about how your life is going. But you don't get to own them and also have the freedom of experience that makes life meaningful. I was arguing with somebody, and it turned out better than it had started on Facebook. And she had first projected a lot of stuff about why I thought what I thought. And I said, that's not really the point. Don't worry about my past. Worry about the human species past. It took her a little while to come around, and then I think she did. And finally, you know, from admitting that she was very monogamous, she admitted that she and her husband, of course, had flirtations. They just didn't give in to them. And I'm saying, okay, that is what I'm saying. If we honor biology, we notice that we are a tribal species. The economics of the tribe dictate that we get along with a lot of people and that we interact with a lot of people. The economics of a tribe ask us not to bind ourselves into small homes where we limit our resources and even our fertility, but that we join in larger groups. And I don't know if she came to understand this a little bit more or simply was more forgiving of that idea. She seemed to be coming at it from some sort of, you know, pop psychology point of view, in which you have to look at somebody's childhood to figure out why their relationship fails. And that's just a construct. You know, this idea of, oh, this is perfect. This situation is perfect. Two people living in a little tiny life pod together is perfect. And if that doesn't work for you, you really have to go to the therapy because you've given up religion. So go to the therapy and cry with each other and hold each other and say, you're really the only one for me. I know we're on our life journey together. Okay, well, except when you're not. Except when the normal human dynamic of people not being able to satisfy the complexity of somebody's personality gets to you and overwhelms you, and you're just not able to live it the whole way through. And you need the complexity of the group. We are by nature a group animal, and in many ways we're also a solitary animal. Now, how do you reconcile those two things? You allow us to be a group animal sometimes and a solitary animal at other times. But we're never solely a two-person animal, except in romantic moments. I'm reminded of so many tribal habits and tribal customs. Let's see. You'd have to go through tribes and look at the anthropologist's reports. But the Trobianders, or you can look at the people of Papua New Guinea, or you can look at the Maori, you can look at the... I once very briefly dated a very nice Australian girl. Very, very nice, as opposed to other Australians. No. She was very, very nice. And she was charming as can be, and genuine as can be. And she was a masseuse. And she was, I think, going to give me a back rub. And I said, oh, I don't know, there's a little hair here or there. She said, oh, no, it's nothing. I'm used to massaging hairy Marys. Hairy Marys. Oh, it's nothing. Hey, it's nothing. Oh, it's nothing. She wasn't from wherever that accent's from. She wasn't from there. So, anyway, she was used to massaging hairy Maoris, but... So, you can look at the Maori tribes and look at the way they organize their relationship structures. Pretty hard on the women at times. Men really never had it bad. Men always kind of were able to do what they wanted to if they did the hard work of going and killing things. And because they did that hard work, they were usually congratulated by, fine, take extra wives, fine. Women weren't, if I say that women were property of the home, that's not always as bad as you think. Women ran the home, and they organized the home, and they always had the privilege, or often had the privilege, of berating their husbands with long, long litanies of words and emotions that made them feel bad about things. And that's sort of one of the paybacks that women got. And then men would go into their little men's groups and talk about whatever they talked about. Most tribes weren't excessively honest. There were Native American tribes in which women had some rights. I'll have to learn to be more specific about the various tribes. That might be interesting. Oh, that will be interesting work to share with you, to share that with you. Well, this is American Heretic. My name is Liam Sheff. My books are Official Stories and Others. Put a couple dollars into the PayPal. See you around the bend. Stay tuned. We're not done yet. Welcome back to the show. Liam Sheff, Official Stories, American Heretic, funded by you. Contribute a couple dollars to the PayPal, or buy a book. It's a gift that keeps on giving, so I've been told, and yeah, it's a gift of love. It really is. I've told that story before. I'll tell it again another time. I want to think about this argument that relationships, though, are an economic, a romanticized form of economics. So, our primary relationships, then, are a romanticized form of economics. What do I mean? Our relationships are a romanticized form of economics. We get into a relationship, we have to keep the lifeboat afloat. Now, in previous societies, we had houses to lean on. We had households, I should say, to lean on, and clans to lean on. Now, my mother, who is a narcissist, I love my mother, but she's a narcissist. She really is. She's wasted so much money on rent with her slightly idiotic husband, who they've just spent and spent and spent and spent money that I've never had and I've never seen and never heard of. I'm surprised at how much they've spent on rent living in an expensive area. I didn't grow up with money. My mother truly sacrificed my childhood so that she could become a doctor. I didn't see her from age sort of 4 to 12. It really, murdered my childhood so she could become a doctor. And she always hated her job, and she hated the idiots who she had to work for, who were all men living in men's privilege, putting people down who didn't agree with them. So I learned a lot about how medicine works in that environment. And I learned that she would come home with tears coming down her face. Why don't they take me seriously? Why don't they take me seriously? Because you're a stupid woman. I mean, that was the answer. She, you know, and she knew it because she was a stupid woman. And instead of saying, this isn't worth my time and effort, she said, well, I'll show them. And she learned to play their game, et cetera, and learned to be respected among people who don't know a thing about biology or nutrition and so forth and so on. But she has spent so much money on rent instead of investing in a clan structure, a familial structure. So I have absolutely nothing to show for her work. And she really built her career by sacrificing my child to the gods. Now, the gods of medicine and, you know, sort of medical debt slavery, which she was in until just a few years ago. I mean, the loans that she had to take out to get through medical school were, for her, excruciating. And she didn't have to do it for my sake. She told me it was for my sake. And I thought, well, I would have preferred that you had been a school teacher. We would have been organically poor, and I would have been surrounded by learning. But that's not something that she needed her parents' approval. So she went back, and they were doctors, so she had to be a doctor. And she's brilliant, you know. She really is, but dumb as can be when it comes to like looking inside and figuring out how to actually live a satisfying life. So instead of investing in that clan structure, my mother invested in sort of the capitalist petroleum medical model, and it was, you know, it was torturous. It didn't make me hate doctors, by the way. I you know, I liked a lot of the people she worked with. There were some really fun people there, so it's not that simple an equation. But I did see how the system grinds the organic personality to dust. I really liked a lot of the people she worked with, and they were clever, funny. Some of them were. One of them was a really good piano player, and really sparked my interest in being able to play the piano, which I do. So it wasn't, you know, I mean, there are always little silver linings, but the overall message was, this field is one that takes away your humanity and pulls you away from your family structure, and that's what happened to me growing up. It was, you know, really kind of morbidly painful, but that's true. That happened, and my mother is a narcissist and can't take any responsibility for any of that. It's, you know, she just, it's just, you know, oh, it's the past. Oh God, da da da. Never invoked God when I was growing up, but now if I bring up, well, if you had actually made better choice, oh God, forgiveness, God forgive. Oh, shut up. Honestly, religion is such the first refuge of all scoundrels is religion. It's just so boring. You know, the way that we seek forgiveness is to own the bullshit that we've done. Now, in fairness, if she had had a guy who stuck around like my father didn't, she might have made better decisions. And that's always her sort of like, well, I'm sorry your father didn't stick around. Yeah, well, he didn't, but you didn't have to put me in the hands of psychotic people, child molesters, abusers, drug addicts. That was your choice, not his. So there's a lot of hard feeling there and a lot of bad blood, but you know, we all love our mothers. I do love my mother. She gave birth to me. I remember her from childhood as, of course, a wonderful soul who was sort of tortured, self-tortured and tortured by others into becoming something else. But the model of family, though, was really lost because she gave in to the capitalist model of raising kids rather than the organic model of seeking family, you know. What if she had sought her brothers? She had three brothers, has three brothers, and mother and father, and they'd said, oh, you're welcome here. Even though your husband was allowed, you're of course welcome in the family home. Now, this is the traditional model of raising kids. Kids are raised in the maternal home, not the paternal home. Father's rights are, you know, a very recent idea and really an offshoot of feminism. You have to understand that feminism helped enslave the male as much as it used to enslave the female. So now both male and female are enslaved into a kind of factory system of raising kids. A factory system of working. You go to work and you're there all the time, and then kids are raised in the school. Sorry, I misspoke there. Kids are raised by the state, and mother and father serve capitalism by going and sacrificing planet Earth in their shitty job, which they hate. You know, then they're always silver linings, the person you get to flirt with, the raise here, the attaboy once in a while, good job. You know, when women are noticed as being as criminally, psychotically, narcissistically destructive as men, they get a raise and an attaboy, and they think that that's progress. But really, all tribes rely on women to raise children because children need their mothers more than any other thing. Now, I had that robbed of me by her and by my father. And yeah, that's a scar. I will not lie to you. It's a hard one to deal with. And, you know, I don't exclude my mother from my life. I can't include her very much because she's not well balanced enough and honest enough about the past to have a meaningful dialogue with that extends beyond, much beyond, current events and some medical issues here and there. And I appreciate that we occasionally have those talks. And I do love my mother. My father's sort of another story. There's, some mutual guy-to-guy appreciation for the gifts that are probably in the family line, but as a guy, man, he needs a good ass-kicking. He really needs a good, solid fucking ass-kicking. And I'd be happy to hand it to him, just to straighten him out, because, I don't know, that guy just disappeared into his own bullshit and couldn't stand up and couldn't be proactive in the tribe that he started to create. I don't begrudge him for leaving my mother. My mother's difficult. I begrudge him for not sticking by the family unit in a more reasonable way and saying, hey, don't worry, we don't have to be married, but I'm not going to abandon you guys. I mean, here's some money, and I'm going to visit. What he did was he met a succubus, like an incubus. He met a woman who had learned the art of narcissism and the art of intense interpersonal shame and abuse, of using people's fear against them. She is actually a narcopath, my father's second wife, who, he was married to her by the time I was three, so that's a very long-term relationship. But she is a narcopath and has had, many issues that let people around her know that she's intensely mentally ill. But when I was a kid, of course, there was no demarcation of that. So, she just got him to fear and hate everybody that she feared and hated, and isolated their pod from everybody else's pod, including, from their own kids, my half-brothers. They're really scarred by that narcopathy. So I didn't grow up with healthy models. So I looked outside, as opposed to, I had this this woman sort of giving me a little bit of shit online. Oh, you don't like marriage because you grew up in a bad marriage. No, actually, I sought healthier models because the models at home are such bullshit. And I looked at all of the models of relationships. Now, people who grow up with people who sort of stay together and cling together through the hard times, learn to cling together through the hard times. There's nothing wrong with that. But they don't question the basic fundamentals. Because my situation was so bad, I had to question the thing all the way down to nuts and bolts. Because I had such a hard time, I mean, I barely survived it. It almost killed me a number of times. But because I had it so hard, I learned to question the nuts and bolts. And by questioning the nuts and bolts, I eventually came out in looking at society as an organized system of economics, and how do people organize, and what is love? Romance does seem to fade and give in to long-term friendship and supportive household relationships. Romance comes and goes and binds people together so that they form those longer term relationships. I've become more of a critical thinker about relationships because the shit at home was so bad. But I don't reject romance. I love romance. But I also don't mistake romance, or I try not to. I do mistake it sometimes, as something that can last forever. Romance comes and goes. And I always feel love and romance towards certain people in life, and they're people who simply just draw a feeling of deep I love yous, from my heart, and I'm, involved with, I have, there are people that I care about very, very, very much. I try to keep some of that private on the show, but there are people, and maybe a person who I care most about, and who's deeply special to me that way, but she has to tolerate this, guy who says, yes, that's wonderful, but our primary job is not to bind each other with promises, but to support each other through life's changes. So that's really who I am on the inside and on the outside. So, it's always a little bit of juggling. Now, if we're going to talk about the nature of the human species over time, though, we have to talk about the economics of the human tribal structure as it gave way into the human town structure, the human farming structure. And it is to that I think I'll turn to in the next segment. We really moved from being... How do I say this? We really moved from being a tribal hunter-gatherer society in which it was impossible to do anything but raise children in groups, to let women restrict sex because they didn't want to get pregnant. Pregnancy destroyed their bodies. Pregnancy exhausted them. Children exhausted them. Oh, the idea that children are just a blessing You just go to some of the transcripts of what ancient of modern tribal people encountering anthropologists have said. Children are a burden. We're fucking tired of it. We're exhausted by children. We want to retain a little bit of our looks, and the children just suck the life out of us. So mothers learn, mothers, as Will Durant has said, and are, are the inventors of abortion, of contraception, of infanticide. Believe it or not, mothers sometimes don't want to be exhausted by something that they can't keep up with, which will suck all of the life out of them. Now, you're saying that all mothers are like that. I'm not saying all mothers are like that. I'm saying that motherhood is a limited resource, and mothers have to learn to manage it as much as, men need to manage animals and game on the hoof, so that we don't eat all of it, or that we learn to save. Well, actually, women helped us save. Women are always the ones who help us save things. Men are such gluttons. Women can be, but they can't afford to be. They have a bloody monthly cycle that teaches them that they need to reserve energy. They have these little monkeys sucking the life milk out of them all the time, so they have to constantly have a reserve of energy. And if they don't get it, they can die, and then the next generation can die. So there's long games of economic stability. This is Liam Schaff. My book is Official Stories. This is American Heretic. We'll be back in the next segment. I will talk about the economics. I will try to formalize, streamline a thought about the economics of monogamy and the economics of the monogamy system that we think is all about romance and trust and promise. It's not. It's about economics and always has been. Romance comes and goes, but the household has to stay put or the society falls the fuck apart. Be back in a minute. We are so often told that romance binds us together forever, that once we make this promise to be one thing to each other, we always must be, that love is the reason for marriage. It will come as a surprise to most Americans and many Europeans, but not to most Africans, people of the Middle East, of Asia, or of Oceania, that marriage has very little traditionally to do with love. The beginning of marriage was capture of, well, somebody else's women so that your tribe could produce more healthy children. That was formalized into trade with dowries and bride prices, that sort of thing coming along. Now we have a formalized $30,000, event in which people promise to be something to each other forever, then fail in some way or another and either go to the priest, which is a bad idea, or the counseling machine, which will suck thousands of dollars out of you just so that you can be told that you have a neurosis because you're attracted to people, and you have a fear of intimacy because sometimes you're not attracted to the person at home who's gained 60 pounds and you don't know what to do about that without hurting his or her feelings, or you're just human. Or you have to go, of course, to the divorce machine and pay another $30,000 to $60,000 to $150,000 so that you can obliterate the thing that you started with the promise that you shouldn't have made at all. Because it's not a promise that is really based in the real reason for marriage. The real reason for marriage isn't romantic love, it's economic. This is upsetting to a lot of Americans who believe in Santa Claus and Jesus. So what isn't upsetting to Americans? Let's talk about it. My name is Liam Schaff. My book is Official Stories. This is American Heretic. American Heretic funded by you. PayPal links are to the side and below. If we're going to ask the question, what and why, excuse me, of monogamy, we have to look at biology, anthropology, history, prehistory, what we call prehistory, which is not, of course, prehistory, but pre-writing. And we end up asking the question, are we a monogamous species? Now, traveling around the world, to the tribes of the world, the civilizations of the world. We don't find any evidence of biological monogamy. There is nothing in the human frame that says you can only mate with one person in a lifetime or produce children with one person in a lifetime. Actually, female vocalization during orgasm, loud female vocalization during orgasm, the sperm competition in the uterus and vagina seem to indicate that we're built for many sex acts, even during a period of heat, not estrus, but ovulation. This is covered by Chris Ryan and Kasil Dejethi in their book Sex at Dawn, but they're just, quoting the medical research and literature, anthropological research and literature, knitting it together. We're not biologically a monogamous animal. Now, people will come along and say that spiritually we owe it to each other to promise genital, I don't know what you want to call it, slavery to each other. There's no tribe on earth that's ever practiced this, especially the American tribe. And perhaps we should focus on the American tribe a little and figure out our economic system. Our economic system, as opposed to every tribe that ever existed or civilization that existed, is a two-person household. Now, the Greeks didn't practice life in a two-person household, no matter which city-state or polis you're talking about. They practiced a large extended family with many, many slaves. Slaves in the wealthy families outnumbering the blood inhabitants by 10 to 1. The Roman households were the same. Large extended families, including many, adoptive members and many slaves. And slavery in the ancient world isn't like chattel slavery of the Americas where you're whipped and beaten all the time, although that did happen in the mines. Slaves in Rome were often well-paid people living very expensive, cushy lives working for wealthy people. You'd have to consider it more like a company man. Slavery in the ancient world under the Romans especially was more like being a company man. You could be a slave just abused and used in the mines and die in short order. You could work in the fields and that's tough work. You could essentially be used for sex. And if you were good at it, you could have a very good life. Things left to slaves who were lovers, both heterosexual and homosexual. So the ancient world's household ran on slavery or servitude or serfdom and large extended families. In the ancient world, sex was available any time of the day or night. You could walk down to the various neighborhoods and hills of ancient Rome and pay for a little bit of whatever you wanted. The ancient Greek world had no prohibition against sex with whomever you wanted. The only real prohibitions against sex, and these weren't really followed, were to be a receptive partner in homosexuality. That was left to the slaves. But of course, if you wanted to, you would, and you'd keep it discreet. What you'd call being a top as a homosexual was looked at with great respect because you're even more of a man. So our ideas of homosexual and heterosexuality in the modern world have no currency in the ancient world. They're total modern, frankly homophobic constructs that don't, again, carry any real historical weight, except they do pop out of some references in Judaism and Leviticus, which is where we do get a lot of our marching orders, which is problematic. So economics of the household in the ancient world moved around how you maintained paying all of those people, and you needed energy. I've said before that the energy of the ancient world was grain, therefore the energy of the ancient world was sunlight and the ability to procure food from the land. The Egyptians, who had the best land of the ancient and world and for long, long, long periods of time because of the regularly flooding Nile, and they held the fertile material spewed out of the Nile in the lands. They became very, very good at that sort of intensive canal farming or holding the water in paddies and keeping the fertility there. That was the breadbasket of the world if the world was the Mediterranean. And the Romans essentially held in serfdom Egypt so they could have that currency. Well, the ancient Roman world, they had the Latifundia and then Egypt, the ancient Roman world depended on that. So you depended on slavery and serfdom and so on. You couldn't have a two-person household with that need of a number of people to do that kind of work. And imagine every other kind of work you had to do without oil. I mean, you had to make everything from buttons to fabrics. You had to have flax and hemp and every other thing in the ancient world, from the tribes of the Americas to the tribes of the Asiatic nations and the Oceanic nations. You had to do work to procure everything. This changed in the era of coal and oil, and so you see the English change. The English lived essentially the same way of the Romans, but they had the mental influx of Christianity, which made people crazy, just crazy. And because the priesthood was forbidden from engaging in normal sexual activity after a certain point, they just started punishing people for having sex. So the Western mind lives in this terrible conflict. The people in charge of our spiritual well-being had sexuality forbidden to them. And they all went fucking crazy. And so they forbade sexuality to the rest of us. And that's really where we live. We lived in a divisive place between what we did to the priestly class so that they wouldn't have kids and divide the property of the church in Rome. That's what happened, by the way. To the romanticization of this two-person model, which really only has to do with the idea that sex is shameful, so you should only be ashamed with one person versus more than one person. That's really it. No, the tribal structure of the entire world is dependent on people getting along with each other, and women usually had to manage their menses and their childbirth and their lactation, breastfeeding, etc. Men didn't have much to do with that. You know, women owned that magic. And they managed childbirth by breastfeeding for much longer, by weaning much later so they were less likely to get pregnant, or by holding off sex. Everything changed at the advent of agriculture. That's sort of a different story. Let's talk about what happened from the feudal state, which was infected by the Judeo-Christian fake idea of, you know, fake women ownership and men sin. Men were still allowed to go to the brothel. That's what Chaucer was writing about. That's what courtly love was really about. Men would write poems to people who were unavailable to them. You really think they were unavailable to them? I don't think so. Chaucer even writes about that there were plenty of people going around getting it on in the Middle Ages. You know, the idea of Christ telling you what to do with your genitals just didn't stick. And in the modern era, in the Victorian era, which was the coal era, the steampunk era for people into that kind of thing, but it was the era driven by coal, the household, which became larger because of the added power to the economy through coal, became much larger. It was still full of slaves and servants. Just ask what's that terrible Gosford Park, or what's that terrible show that people love? I can't remember, but it's like Upstairs Downstairs, and they redid it, and it was on for years and years. And it's about this, you know, English household with an American mother. Everybody's screaming the name, and I can't remember it for the life of me. But anyway, you have this, you know, where people are wealthy, they need so many people around to do all of the things that the ancient serf and slave culture did. Now, that was replaced by something. It was replaced by, I always say it, it's oil. 5.8 million British thermal units for 42-gallon barrel. So doing a year and a half of round-the-clock machine work, 24-hour-a-day work per barrel, or 5 to 7 years of a day job per barrel of oil, and using 20 million of those per day in the United States, we now don't need the other slaves that we used to have, who people used to have sex with and relationships with and make kids with. That's in the Bible, by the way. That's what you can't have a kid, I'll have a kid with the slave. Oh, no, she's more important. That happened all the time. Men who were wealthy always had more women because they could afford more children. It wasn't really a big deal, and then the women had more help. The romanticization of the Victorian idea, though, men and women lived very, very different lives in the coal era, very, very different lives in the Victorian era. There was men's world and women's world, and the twain often didn't meet. Orgasms were so unknown to Victorian men that women had to go to doctors and they had to invent a vibrator. There's a movie about that. I can't remember what it's called. Maggie Gyllenhaal is in it. And it's based on, you know, the reality of the invention of the mechanical vibrator to give women's orgasms so they wouldn't have women's spells and fainting and so on. Hysteria, it's called hysteria, named after hyster, the uterus. So our romanticized Hallmark card vision of monogamy is just that. It's a romanticized Hallmark card version of something that never existed, ever existed. Women's rights came around in the 70s, really, at the era of high use of oil. And feminism instead of really freeing women, actually just moved women into the psychotic workplace where they replicate the same kind of raping of nature job. You know, you can get equal wages for equal pay, but equal pay at what? Nothing useful. Just raping the land to make more Coke and Pepsi and, you know, work in advertising and other meaningless pursuits that sell petroleum products to more dupes and people and enslave us all. So women got to rise to the level of equal slavery in a slave system of petroleum use, as men did. And men were told that they had to behave exactly like women in relationships and no longer have the fun and freedom that they used to have. Women and men then became equal in a slave system. It's what feminism did. And women had a right to be paid equally, treated equally. That's not what I'm talking about, and not hurt in any way. I'm saying, though, that we really lost the thread. We were never a sexually monogamous species. We were an economically household-bound species. And we can still be economically household-bound and respect the household and respect, you know, not giving a lot of, having a lot of children outside of the household, or if we do, we have rules about that and that sort of thing. We could figure that out if we could talk about it, but we can't because we're so behind the veil of the myth of romantic lifelong monogamy, which doesn't happen for anybody. I mean, the best that I've heard is, oh, yeah, we like to flirt, but we have to suppress it all the time so we can reinvest that energy in each other. Okay, all right. Yeah, I don't want to get in the middle of those fights. And you're at home wondering why you're failing each other spiritually. Nothing's easy, and people who say, oh, this doesn't work, jealousy gets in the way. Yeah, jealousy comes up, but you have to figure out why you're in a household together. You have to figure out what your overall goals are. Is your goal to, my goal with the significant person, people in my life, permaculture projects, you know, whatever they're involved with, my goals are permaculture projects. What are your goals? Or my goals are to support, let's say you have kids, and your goals are to support the raising of kids. You have these larger projects together that are much more important to you than the momentary Hallmark card fixation. Now, those moments are beautiful and fun, and I'm not knocking them down to nothing. They make life joyful. And I recommend that you invest in them and, you know, buy the accoutrements that you need, whether it's chocolate or whatever works for you. I'm saying don't mistake, though, the Hallmark card version for reality, and don't crucify each other for not living up to something that never existed. This is Liam Sheff. I am author of Official Stories. This is American Heritage. See you next time. So, if we understand then that the economics are what drive our social affiliations with each other, then we can kind of forgive each other for flirtations or affections. But then you have to ask the big questions. Like, let's say that you really like somebody and you're in a position and you would talk about, hey, honey, we've been together for years and I would love to have a child with this person. And you know, the Spartans actually allowed that. If there was a guy who had some kids with somebody, but he was getting older, because Spartan men were always older than Spartan women, although Athenian men were much older than their wives, whereas Spartan men were a little closer in age. But if a Spartan husband was just kind of too old, and the woman was just seen as, you know, truly a eugenic cream of the crop, the Spartans were very much like that. A man could approach and say, hey, do you mind if I could we do each other the honor, of allowing your wife to make a child with me, because she is of such prime stock, she is of such incredible lineage and strength and beauty, and you know, strength being the operative thing in Spartan culture. And that transaction would take place. Yeah, of course you can. Thank you for honoring my wife, and we'd be happy to, because in Sparta the children were raised essentially in barracks, so it didn't really matter anyway. It was a very, very hard and demanding life for the boys who lived. Those who weren't fit, were exposed. So there was a lot of, you know, it was a very eugenic society, the one that we celebrate with Gerard Butler in the 300. Where did we start, though? What were we talking about? Oh, yeah, the economics, though, in the modern world, you know, because we're all told to be in these two-person suburban plywood-walled homes, and we're all supposed to live this way, we actually believe it. You know, we believe that this is the way that we have to live, and we're afraid to do anything else. The state taxes us as couples, so you couldn't live in an extended home, and it's difficult to live in an extended home with, you know, two wives or three husbands or something like that, unless you're just dispositionally okay with it. Somebody was complaining on one of my videos on the fake book that she had been raised in a Mormon home, and it was a, you know, another kind of mental slavery where you're told how to be and told you have to get married this way. And I wrote her and I said, we're kind of parsing here. You're talking about religion and I'm talking about sexuality. So we're still talking about force. If you're forced to be in a relationship that you don't want to be in, you're not going to enjoy it. But if I'm talking about adults making decisions in which they're quite aware, you may derive a great deal more enjoyment or growth or happiness from that, or at least you'll understand that you have chosen it. All of life, of course, has elements of suffering, unfortunately. So how would you proceed then? Let's say that you're older, you've been married for a while, you have a kid, and you say, I'd like to have some extra freedoms. And so you have extra freedoms, and that's going well for a while, and then somebody comes home and goes, shit. Shit what? Well, I'm pregnant, or somebody else is pregnant. Oh. Well, now you have to have a very different set of discussions, which is, do we have an abortion, or does your girlfriend have an abortion, or do we have enough money that you can actually have this kid and know that we're going, or is this person somebody I can tolerate and get along with, and that we'll essentially raise our kids together? Until you say that last bit, you're like, oh my God, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? Well, you could decide to raise the kids together. This is, of course, unheard of in the modern world. Of course, it also happens all the time in the modern world. And people of two-family divorces, where everybody's remarried now, Brady Bunch style, but they end up raising kids together, or not Brady Bunch style, they end up raising kids together. Yeah, well, Brady Bunch style, but imagine that both of those people's spouses weren't dead, that's how they got away with it on the Brady Bunch, and they were just divorced. Imagine then that there were all of these combined families that said, shit, let's put aside our differences and get along. That actually happens sometimes. Sometimes it doesn't work, sometimes it does work. But there are high-functioning combined families out there too. And that's worth noting. We are able to do these things. It is built into the species to be able to tolerate each other enough and well enough, if we have a little bit of personal space, to enjoy stepbrothers and stepsisters as siblings, and to really care about them, or half-brothers and half-sisters as siblings. I have two half-brothers, and I loved them very much growing up. I haven't been able to see them because my father did such a good job of destroying and exploding the family that, and it not sort of taking responsibility for his bullshit, that it's difficult to talk with them because they have to take a side. You know, they have to take a side, and I definitely take a side, which is that my father was totally irresponsible and kind of a shithead. And instead of, you know, that's sort of harder for them to be okay, because our divisive society makes people take sides. On the other hand, I know couples, and I've known couples who've been divorced, whose kids get along and they tolerate, or even are still very good friends with. They decided that because the romance faded from the relationship was no reason to destroy a good family structure, and they're managing okay. There seem to be possibilities in us if we allow us to think of ourselves as having possibilities. If we decide there are no possibilities, well, we don't get any, do we? I mean, if we decide there's nothing to do but what the church and state say, then we fail and we go to the divorce machine or the church monster and totally sacrifice everything and grind it into dust and bits. And what's left? Nothing. Just hatred and acrimony and maybe vengeance and retribution or projection and psychological torment. So I end up with a mother, personally, me, Liam, ends up with a mother and father who are very immature, psychologically unfulfilled, psychologically immature, throwing money, which, you know, I wish they would have sent my way, but didn't, into their own holes in their psyche to try to prop up something that fulfills some of their needs in their lives, instead of just facing a past in which they made terrible, terrible, isolating decisions. Terrible, terrible decisions which didn't work out for anybody. And because they all had to start over. Now, my father started over very, like, immediately with a woman who found him and found the Jewish doctor that she was looking for, she being a narcissistic, probably terribly abused, anorexic, bulimic, chain-smoking, black-eyed wraith of a woman, if you can call her that, found this guy and tangled him up. He was very weak-minded in her web and pulled him away from all of his responsibilities except to that of injecting children with poison. It's called being a pediatrician and making money. And she got a lot of out of that because she married up. You know, she was essentially some sort of hillbilly coal miner's daughter without the talent or the grit of Loretta Lynn. And she just found, and, you know, since he was so un-Jewish, it was okay, and she could sort of bend him into celebrating everything else, being Christian about it, and fitting in, and, you know, so she got that. But she didn't have a sense of community about her, because the narcissistic culture of heavy fundamentalist Christianity or Catholicism that spit her out broken in pieces couldn't do anything but make a broken family, which had to isolate people from each other rather than bring in people. You know, she could have brought me in and welcomed me as family, but she had to see me as the enemy, the other, because my mother was so smart, and she, my stepmother, was really not as... She was clever and conniving, but she wasn't as intellectually gifted in any way as my mother. She looked at me as a threat, and I was seen, instead of something to be enjoyed and celebrated, as, you know, she had to put me down and call me stupid. So I actually thought I was stupid growing up, which may surprise you, but I didn't. I was told all sorts of terrible things about myself. And because she said those things, I guess I carried them through, and I was so full of doubt, I was afraid to try things. So you can see how, and I had to talk to myself about that and be more willing to try things over time. So you can see how one broken person infects another, and I think that our system is a system of broken people lasting hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and thousands of years. The psychic damage is done, and it takes somebody, well, like myself, or maybe like you, to stand up and say, I'm going to examine these things, because I'm not, the system that I've inherited is so broken, it's making me so unhappy, it's making me suicidal. The system that I had inherited was so broken by the time it got to me, it made me feel suicidal. So I really had to examine it, and I had to say, look, the things that you're thinking and teaching me are crazy. They don't work, and I have to have the courage to defy parental logic. And I have to tell you, it takes great courage to defy parental logic. It's hardwired into us as a mammalian species to obey parental logic in some fashion. I had to reject almost every piece of parental logic that came my way. It was so hard to do, because you know, you feel so unmoored from anything. You have to just go one little piece at a time, one little piece at a time, finding reasonable replacements in cultural models, historical models, literary models, psychological models, and through therapy and guidance and meditation and loving other people and learning from other people, being very open to being criticized in terms of making mistakes, you know, just to replace all of the broken pieces that you inherited from, you know, the monstrous parents. So most people with families like me didn't turn out like me. I just had a rather intense will not to be a poisonous person. You know, I had an intense will not to be a person who would hurt other people's feelings, or, you know, that sort of thing. So I had to go through all of that. And of course I did hurt people's feelings and yelled and had all kinds of, you know, relationships that were full of acrimony that I had to pay attention to and say, there's something wrong here, and I'm sure a lot of it, it's my fault. But just that willingness to say there's something wrong here and a lot of it's my fault isn't present in most people. We're just not good at that. And then people who say that are often victimized by the narcissist in the world. So you have to have a limit to that too. Something wrong here, some of it's my fault, but not all of it can be my fault. So we're going to find a balance and explore it fairly in a system in which we're all validated to some degree as having a right to exist. So, right, so that's a lot of my personal process, and that's sort of how I've gotten here. And, you know, that's me being open, as I always am. It doesn't make us a monogamous species. And if you say, well, you would have been happy if your parents had stayed together. No, they hated each other. I wouldn't have been happy. I would have been much happier, though, if they had said, we don't get along well romantically, so we're not going to force that as an issue. What we're going to do, though, is honor the tribe that we built. And if either of us has other kids, we're going to add those to the tribe. How great! We'll have an even more supportive tribe. Then my father would have been able to go forward and say, I'm going to carefully find a woman to interact with because I had such bad luck the first time in finding a good match for myself at home. I'm going to be really careful and go very, very slowly. And it would have taken him years, not months, to find, well, he actually found her before they got divorced, which tells you a lot about his mindset. You know, he was running, not just for my mother. His father died, and he had a total psychological collapse because his father, I think, who had been really abusive to him, and my father modeled his identity on pleasing his father's expectations. When his father died, I think my father really fell apart, and that happened when I was in utero. So there are really deep psychic scars there. And I'm very connected through the death of that grandfather to my father's psychic scars, I think, energetically, whatever you want to call it. But if my father had waited, you know, and just gone into therapy and said, you know, it's not a great time for me to be divorcing and remarrying. Actually, I'm just going to take it slow. My life could have been very different. And I could have been surrounded by people who understood the transient nature of romance, but understood the absolute necessity of supporting long-term tribal, call them familial structures. And what a blessing that would have been. What a blessing that would have been. And now I'm talking about it, you know. I don't know that anybody in the popular culture talks about these things. I really talk about things that nobody else talks about. Or at least if anybody talks about them, they end up talking about a couple of them, and I seem to talk about more of them than anybody else, which is strange, but there it is. That's just what I do. And it is not free, and nobody pays me to do it unless you put a couple dollars into the PayPal. So that's what that's about. Yeah. And it's appreciated when you do it, believe me. It touches my, it touches my heart, actually. I'm always amazed when people care about it enough to put a couple dollars in. So, you know, thank you to the people who do. I don't say your names on the air because I don't want to, I don't know, some people don't like being embarrassed or whatever, but thank you. All right, we may do a little best of segment for the last couple segments of the show, but it has been an interesting show, a deep show, and it has been about love and relationships and tribe. My name is Liam Schaff. My books are Official Stories, Truth About Love. There are some others there on the Amazon if you want to look around, create space. This is Liam Schaff Show, American Heretic. We'll be back with something for the remainder of the show. Let's see what we can find. Stay tuned, and stay tuned to all the great programming on Truth Frequency Radio and UCY TV. ended the last episode talking about sex, talking about a more libertine society versus a more conservative society. Now, you may have an upset stomach when you hear about libertine societies like those in the Trobriand Islands, the South Pacific, the tribal people who trained their young men how to please women by coupling them, partnering them with slightly older girls in the group, you know, 20-somethings going out with teenage boys to teach them how to please women. Well, this happens and happened. But it's all about how much energy you have in the society. We misunderstand how we organize around sex as being a simply moralistic venture, that there's a right and a wrong about young adults and adults. You know, people of let's be clear, I'm talking about people of sexual age. So anybody else with any other thoughts in their head, go to another channel. People of sexual age who are able to conceive, etc., etc. There are many, many thoughts about there's one thought in the West about how to organize that, and it's about like shame and what is appropriate. And you can tell that we have no idea what's appropriate by the number of mixed messages we send from the sort of pornographic Mickey Mouse Club that throws its little tarts at us at ridiculously young ages, doing dances that are not appropriate for very, very young girls to do for a mass audience, the Britney Spears effect, Christina Aguilera effect until they get older, and then they're broken people. Well, Christina managed, but Britney was a broken person. To the HPV pogrom, which fears that all young women, because we're so liberal, are actually 50-year-old drug-injecting prostitutes who need to have their sex lives managed pharmaceutically. We don't know what we're doing or talking about regarding sex. Hold on, there's a siren. I'm going to pause. As I said, we don't know what we're doing regarding sex because we don't understand the source and origin for sexual freedom versus incredible sexual, I would say, conservatism. This is American Heretic. My name is Sirens. Whatever, you live with it. My name is Liam Sheff. You can put a couple dollars into the PayPal. I talk about this and other issues in Official Stories, which is available on Amazon.com for a song. So sex is something that we're all born eventually going to grow into wanting. Sex is the expression not just of love, but of desire. And desire has to do with mysteries that we don't understand. Desire is, I want to encounter somebody who turns me on, turns on my mind, turns on my body, turns on my what I feel is my spirit, my energetic spirit, my electromagnetic spirit. We don't know why that happens. We have no idea. It just happens. You can write all the poetry in the world about it. It's still going to happen. You'll never dissect it. You'll never find the part of the brain that tunes you into precisely somebody's pheromone at a particular time of day, at a particular time of your life, that makes you want to remember some stories from Shakespeare, Edward de Vere, if you want to go that way, and I do, or of who's another great, or of Rumi, you know, who turns you on to these wonderful ideas, or who makes you read the Bible and wonder what it is until you get to Song of Songs and goes, well, they're finally making sense. Of course, we're turned on by each other. We're mammalian species. We're excited by each other. Sex drives us nuts, it drives us crazy, we want it, but we also, there's always, the problem with sex is procreation, always. The problem is that sex in people who are of sexual age, who are driven by that pheromonal excitement, hormonal excitement, really doesn't care much about, you know, anybody else's, I don't know, marriage or something. You like who you like, you know. You want to eat a chocolate bar, you want a chocolate bar. You can't do anything about it. So there have always been totems and taboos. There have always been laws or rituals, more realistically, built into cultures to define sex. And those rituals came out of the environment. This is what Freud didn't understand. This is what nobody understands, that everything comes out of an energetic appreciation of the environment. So let's look at the Inuit culture and compare them with the Trobriand culture or a Polynesian culture. Let's say the culture that Captain Cook encountered on his sea voyages. Or that you get in Mutiny on the Bounty. Well, in Mutiny on the Bounty, if I remember correctly, the men got off on a Polynesian island. And I'm sorry if I'm misremembering, but they got off on a Polynesian island and would not get back on the boat to eat hardtack and get scurvy when they're out having gallivanting with these beautiful, beautiful Tahitian island girls for whom sex is a pleasure and is rather free. It's rather libertine or, you know, open. You know, why would they go back to a miserable life on a boat when they can put garlands of flowers around themselves, go catch a pig, you know, cook it under the ground in a fire pit, eat coconuts and bananas and make love. Indeed, and the girls don't seem very possessive. Why go back to England at all? Why go back to a European way of life when you've discovered paradise? There's a reason they called it paradise, and it wasn't the snakes and mosquitoes. It was the fact that life and energy were abundant there. When energy is abundant, you're allowed to let it all hang out. That's what summer camp was about when I was growing up. You'd go, it was summer, food was plentiful, it was terrible, but the food was there, you didn't have to worry about it. And people screwed. A lot of teenagers had a lot of sex at summer camp because there were no annoying parents around with their Judeo-Christian hypocrisy to tell them what to do. And the parents sort of sent the kids away knowing what they were going to do. They're going to break all the rules. They have to do it at some point in their life. So it's coming of age. They're going to Tahiti, you know, up in New York State or California, wherever your summer camp was. So go to this high energy environment where water is plentiful and available because it falls from the sky all the time. Where fats are available in coconuts and other fatty fish and pigs, and so you don't have to worry that much about all the things you need to live, and you can be very healthy. You can enjoy yourself, eat like a king of Europe, and be as poor as anybody else over there in Tahiti or Polynesia. Well, now go to the Inuit culture. They have no vegetables to speak of. Their diet is piss poor. They all get disease young and die young, despite what the Weston A. Price Foundation misunderstands about actual biology. They have terrible stomach ailments, terrible diseases. The elements up there are enough to kill anybody who goes outside or leaves his boots outside, you know, because they'll freeze and they won't be able to use them anymore. You have to have a very eugenic society up there. You know, if somebody isn't healthy, you're not going to feed them anymore. So in traditional Inuit society, once your parents were beyond the state of disrepair, you had to not feed them anymore. Essentially, you had to kill them. And that was ritualized, and there was, you know, some sort of myth about it, how it was honorable and you'd go to the next place with honor. You know, it's always, we always ritualize what's energetically driven. We always ritualize it so we think that it's a good thing to do. Just as headhunters of, you know, wherever, Borneo, ritualized the idea that they were eating the god in the form of the man and so on and so forth. You don't just do these things and think it's a good idea. You have to ritualize it and tell yourself a story. So, there's a side note here. There's a story about boiling frogs I can't remember her name, but one of the whistleblowers in the 9/11 story, her thing is called Boiling Frogs Post. And there's a story that if you put a frog in water and heat it up, the frog will die in the water. That's only partially true, and the studies that I've read are contradictory. So if you put a frog in hot water, it'll jump out. If you put a frog in cold water, it'll jump out, unless the water's so cold it stuns it, or too, so hot it stuns it. But if you put it in temperate water and it likes it and heat the water up, it'll jump out, unless... And this is the argument, you heat it up so slowly that it becomes slowly asphyxiated. And that's the argument, that we're boiling frogs. You put us in water, heat it up slowly, and we don't jump out. The difference, though, between human beings and frogs is that we invent stories, we invent religions. So we'll stay in a very dangerous place because we have a worldview that tells us that nothing bad can happen to us. There were earthquakes around Pompeii before the massive explosion of Vesuvius that, you know, froze it and Herculaneum and the islands in a concrete freeze from the bowels of the volcano. There were great warnings. There are warnings all over the world of things happening all the time. But because we're a storytelling species, we disguise what's going to happen to us from us. We could predict that we're going to run lower on oil because all the fields of the world that were ever vast producers are now mild producers. We can predict, or they don't produce at all anymore to a rate that's economically recoverable. And we could predict what's going to happen to us, but we don't bother because we're storytelling. We inherit our stories from the past. Now when a great calamity happens, we'll write a new story about the great calamity and then we'll remember what happened. See how that works? We don't have good foresight. We can only remember calamity by ritualizing it in a kind of a group memory that we eventually make into a religion. And religion is also what guides our sex life. So if you look at the Inuit, they have religion and ritual that says that not only do they have to kill the weak, but they have to allow sex. Like if I'm married and I'm going out on a hunt, I have to have somebody else from my local area come and sleep with my wife in case anything bad happens to me. I don't want her not to have more children because having children keeps the group alive. You hear what I said? Wife exchange and wife sharing is very prominent among people who have low birth rates or low survival rates. Very, very common. And among people who have a lot of food, the idea of marital fidelity forever just doesn't exist. In fact, even among people who don't have a lot of food, the idea of marital fidelity doesn't exist. It's just the limitation is placed on the woman. If you don't have a lot of resources, you have to fight for the resources. The limitation is placed on the woman in an inheritance-based culture. In a more communistic or communal culture where things are shared, there's not so much pressure on the woman to just bear the children of one man, and there's rather a more kind of healthy, I use the word in the positive sense, eugenic or health-promoting sense of letting a woman have children with her best possible physical mates. And you see this through history. The energy of a society depends on how it's going to organize itself. So a herding society, which has a very hard scrabble life and has to drive animals and drink their blood and drink their milk and occasionally kills a week, is a society that's used to killing. But all of these cattle have to be inherited by the son, and the job of herding has to be passed on to the son. And the job of maintaining the house and raising the children to health has to be maintained by the females. So a man can have as many wives as he can afford, but a woman can only have children by the one male, so she is the bearer of the lineage that he will pass on to. You see how that works? They have a limited amount of energy and a particular way of managing life. But of course, what we call adultery, which is kind of a silly word for, I don't know, you know, not doing that, exists in every culture. Men who are wealthy enough energetically in terms of possessions of grain or meat or, you know, animals are allowed to have as many wives as they can afford. And the more that they have, the more honored they are, because it means the more energy that they have, the wealthier they are. Wealth is energy. It's not money, it's energy. Money is just a stand-in for energy. But if you're in a tribe or a society that has, and you're very wealthy in that society, you know, you're generous, you give gifts, and people eat at your table and give you honors, you can have as much of whatever as you want, but the women have to bear your children. But if you live in a society that's not inheritance-based because you're not farming or you're not herding animals, you're just going to share more equally among the men and women. And in terms of your sex lives, you may fall in love with somebody and have a marriage with them by which you raise a child. But that child is then bound to the mother for the period of breastfeeding and nurturing. That's a couple of years, a few years. Women often don't want to have children in succession, so they'll put off sex. They'll breastfeed for up to 4 years. There are stories in the anthropological literature of, Will Durant was talking about this, of children learning to smoke before they had been weaned of the breast. You know, so women have ways of not getting pregnant again, and they've always practiced that too. We've always been eugenic, you know, abortion and contraception-seeking species, because women don't always want to have more kids. Children are exhausting, and women want to keep their figure and not, you know, die during childbirth. The mythologization, the ritualization of sort of the anti-choice movement, the idea that, you know, abortion is murder. Every tribe on the earth commits murder all the time. We have so much food in this society, people don't see a reason not to keep unwanted kids around. But in societies around the world where the kid isn't wanted or isn't healthy, it's gone. It's brutal. You don't have to like it, but this is the species you belong to. And of course, the abortion state with the Planned Parenthood and the sucking it out of the body and the using the body parts is unbelievably detestable and disgusting. But it's part of the human species in a mechanistic, industrial way. You can see the mechanization, industrialization of something like, you know, population control, which was always practiced. So you can see that sex gets its marching orders from energy. If there's a lot of energy in the society, sex is quite liberal. And there's a lot of energy in our society, and note that sex, despite the old Judeo-Christian mind fucks about it, is quite liberal. People have sex with online and in word and in deed and in photographs and in movies and in hourly hotels and in the affair. And the affair is just there so that people have sex but don't disrupt the two-person lifeboat that keeps the economy going. And I've talked about that. I'll talk about that on the next episode. I'll talk about how the two-person lifeboat is used essentially as a mythologization of morality, but it really only has to do with economics. I've talked about it before. I'll talk about it again.
This is American Heretic. I'm Liam Sheff. A couple dollars in the PayPal. 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, whatever. 5 is fine. 1 is fine. Whatever you can afford if you enjoyed this message or learned something along the way. See you next time.
Proposition, we are not a monogamous country, we just pretend to be. Now, what I've just done is I've put forward an argument as something that we could have a discussion or a debate about. I made my argument, proposition, the United States is not a monogamous country, even though it pretends to be. So there are two parts to this. There's a negative proposition, the United States is not a monogamous country. Well, we have to define what we mean by monogamous. I'll guess that we all know what we mean by country, referring to the United States. Not monogamous, we can define what we mean by monogamous, and we're going to take the negative. And then there's a second part, a subsequent clause, subordinate clause, even though it pretends to be. That's really another matter for a discussion. So that simple sentence, or apparently simple sentence, is pretty complicated. I have to define for you what monogamy is. We both agree what we know, what we can agree on what we mean by country. At least I think that we can agree on that, so we don't have to defend that. Then by defining monogamous, I have to define what I mean by not monogamous. Then I have to further go on to say that it pretends to be something that we've defined it as not being. That's fairly complex. I mean, that's a lot to do in a short little video without a script, top of my head. But that's debate format. I have to present something to you, and I have to present a list of details, a list of evidence. So if I were going to do that, I would have to define monogamy, what we mean by it. Just doing that gets us into a world of trouble, because it's difficult to know what anybody means by it. There are so many ways to define it, and so many ways people practice or don't practice it and still call it that thing, which gets to the subsequent clause, the subordinate clause, even though we pretend to be. That's not what I'm going to talk about in this video. I'm going to talk about debating on the internet, because nobody has any idea what they're doing. They're just wasting their time, and mine, and yours. My name's Liam Sheff. This is American Heretic, funded by you. A couple dollars in the PayPal. PayPal helps very much. My book is Official Stories, which presents counter-arguments to the mainstream narratives. So let's talk about debate. Debate has to come on with a particular proposition. Now, if I put forward an argument and I say the Earth is not flat, most people would say, what? Yeah, of course it's not flat. But a very loud and vocal CIA-funded group of jackasses and idiots on the internet. Now, you see what I just did there. I got your attention. I used inflammatory language. I did. It's a logical fallacy, but I got you. And they're saying, how dare you call me you son of a... And you're ready to do it back. We've already lost track of the argument. The argument was, is the Earth flat or not? That was inherent in my question for those, whatever the way that I said it, for those of you who believe the Earth is flat or don't believe the Earth is flat. If I'm going to debate with you about whether the Earth is flat, well, this is a huge proposition. I mean, we don't see enough. We have to define what we can see. We have to define optics. We have to define the principles and properties of lensing. We have to figure out what the curvature of the Earth is over a distance and how that relates to our optical intake of that information. We have to look at anything from a very high altitude and see if we can see any curve in that. We have to ask ourselves what optics show that is there and what optics don't show that is there. We have to see what cameras do, what the camera that we carry around does. We have to then look at pictures from airplanes, gliders from outer space. We have to argue about the nature of space, the nature of planets, the nature of the moon, the sun, the visible planets to the naked eye, Mars, Jupiter, Venus, your rectum, and the rest of them. I can never let that one go, I'm sorry. You see how complicated a debate can be. I could say, well, prove to me the Earth isn't flat. Did you see what just happened? Now, you've been pushed into a corner. You've been given some deceptively simple argument to talk about. Prove to you the Earth isn't flat. I have to go learn about optics. I have to go learn about curvature over distance. I have to go learn about the rotation of the planet. I have to learn various properties of physics that make sure that we understand that the Earth is moving, atmosphere and all, essentially as close to one body, so that you're not leaving the Earth the moment that you jump 1 inch into the air, so you're not sucked backwards into a vortex of time, space, whatever you think is out there. Then the flat earthers come along and they say, aha, aha, look, there are no flights from here to here. Now we're getting specific. You see what just happened? We're taking the macro argument, the meta argument, the large scale overarching argument, the Earth is round or not round, the Earth is flat or not flat. Prove to me the Earth is round, prove to me the Earth is flat, inversions of each other, same argument, with many different details, and many of the same, and we're taking one detail. When you get into an argument online, people will pull you in and say, everybody knows that HIV causes AIDS. Did you see what they just did? They just shoved you into an argument, like I did in the beginning. I called you a name, and I shoved you into an argument. You now have to defend against me calling you something instead of remembering what the argument is about. So, is the Earth flat or is it round? How many points of information do you need? There are plenty. There are many, many, many. Now, the flat earther comes along and says, we put a camera here and put a laser here. We put a mirror here and a laser here, and it didn't arc the way that it should have, and therefore, the Earth is. Okay. There's your piece of data. We have to go measure that against all the other data. No, no, no. They're done with the argument. And if you don't believe them, that's too bad. There are no flights from South America to Australia. There are no flights from Australia to South America, they say. Well, there are, but they say that there aren't. And that's one of their many proofs. Is it falsifiable? This really matters. When you enter a real debate, and you're in a debate forum or a debate club or a speaker's club, a debate class, and you put forward something, you're going to get a certain amount of time to present your pro argument, and another team over here is going to present their con argument. You're going to present your best for 10 minutes, 8 minutes, 6 minutes, whatever you get, and they're going to present their best for 5, 8, 6, whatever they have, same amount of time, same amount of time. They used to have a water clock, you know, because it would give them the same amount of time. In the ancient world, how much time do you have? They had a clock filled with water, and the pro and the con in a jury trial would give a speech for the exact same amount of time. At least that's the story. So if we give our pro argument, and then we cross-examine each other just for a minute or two, and then we give our secondary argument from some of the questions that we had, some stuff that came up, they give their full argument, their full con argument. We ask a couple of questions, they give their subsequent argument. Now we wait, and we come back, and we have a list of all the things they said, and we try to just knock holes in every one of them. Because that's really the game of debate. You're just trying to knock holes in all of them enough to create that, right, that little reasonable doubt, right? Just, I don't know. Seems like the Earth is round, but they did have trouble with that one laser and that one test, and even though they're not asking to verify it and not, I mean, they could just get people with cameras in the northern hemisphere and cameras in the southern hemisphere to take pictures and photograph the sky at the same time, and if the sky is different, wouldn't it indicate that they were facing different angles in the sky? Don't do that. Because a bad argument doesn't like to be falsified. Now, debate requires that you be able to falsify it, to concede your argument at a certain point. Flat earthers will never concede their arguments. Pro-vaccine people will never concede their arguments, ever. Let's think about that for a second. I had a friend debating vaccination online today. The anti-vaccine, the pro-vaccine person would not concede an argument. So she put forward an argument that said, vaccines are manufactured unavoidably unsafe. Okay, a very specific argument. Not vaccines are evil, no one should ever vaccinate, vaccination has been the scam of the 19th and 20th century. Nothing like that. Not the Earth is flat, just vaccines are manufactured avoidably unsafe. And the guy wrote back and said, oh, that sounds like bullshit. I looked that up. And he posted the paragraph from the finding of the Supreme Court and the subsequent courts that have used that. And it said, vaccines have been manufactured unavoidably unsafe because the disease that they're supposedly protecting against is worse than the terrible thing that can happen, that they admit can happen when they give the vaccine. And my friend, for a moment, was cowed by this, and I said, he just handed you your victory. You said they were unavoidably unsafe. You didn't say that there are no diseases in the world. You didn't say that there were no terrible diseases in the world. You said vaccines were manufactured unavoidably unsafe. But because the guy came back and didn't concede his point, he actually proposed that because there are diseases in the world, that vaccines being unavoidably unsafe are somehow safe. Well, that's a logical fallacy. Just because part A is true, there are terrible diseases in the world, doesn't make part B irrelevant, that vaccines are unavoidably unsafe and can kill you. People don't know how to debate because they don't take it point by point and they don't concede their points. Nobody has ever volunteered what I have asked. I've asked all of the insane people of the internet in the universities to just invite me to their university or hospital, and I will debate HIV testing with them. They always say, HIV causes AIDS, everybody knows that. I say, fine, HIV causes AIDS, everybody knows that. How do you determine that somebody is HIV positive? You use an HIV test. Let's be very specific. When you're going to debate something, you have to be entirely specific about what you're talking about. Is the Earth flat? Well, you have to be very specific. You say there are no flights from South America to Australia, or Australia to South America. Well, what if I find flights with video footage and traveler information and reviews? Is that good enough? What else do you want? What about shadows cast on the Earth from the same using sticks to cast different shadows because of different curvature or different angles of light? What about that? Not good? You don't want that? What about the moon really looking like a rock, a round rock in space that has light cast on it from a certain point that moves slowly around the Earth for 28, 29 day cycles while the Earth spins in 24 hours, thus giving the illusion of a moon that changes over a month? No? Not good? No, the Earth's flat because you say it is. Well, vaccinations are safe because you don't buy that they're not unavoidably unsafe because there are bad diseases in the world? This is pretzel logic. Nobody wants to build a conceivable argument. I mean, we went into the Middle East to look for oil, and we've been holding on to the oil, but you can't concede that because you can create an emotional argument about Saddam Hussein having been a bad guy. Is that the argument? Does Saddam Hussein have to have been a good guy for us to have gone in to hold oil in the Middle East? You see what happens? We're easily tricked. We're easily tricked. These are not the droids you're looking for is not just a story in a Star Wars movie. We're very easily deceived, but it's usually about emotion. Well, you'd be a good American. You're a bad American if. Well, you don't want these children to die, do you? Well, what about polio, huh? You have to be in favor of vaccination because we stopped polio. Bring up the polio arguments. Let's be very specific. Can we define our terms and debate them? Will you concede a point at a time, O loyal opposition? Will you concede that we spray DDT on mass quantities of the population? Will we concede that they used to call polio the rich kids' disease because poor kids who didn't eat fruit that was covered in Paris green, lead, arsenic, and copper didn't succumb to the same paralysis? Will you concede anything in the medical database? Anything, any of it. Will you concede that formaldehyde, squalene, and the polysorbates, the aluminum and thimerosal, the mercury, are neurologically, biologically detrimental? Will you concede any of it? Or does all of that get erased because there are bad diseases in the world? People do not know how to hold a bloody debate. And so they think that they lose all the time. And they argue long past the point that they've won. It happens all the time. If you're really talking with somebody, there are these jackasses and losers. See, I got you. What do you mean, jackasses? You don't even know where I'm going with it, and you're mad. Easiest thing to do is call somebody names. Now, people come and call me names all the time. You don't believe in the flat earth, you Zionist, Rothschild, succubus. Okay, goodbye. You know, no, I don't believe in the flat earth because I look at astronomy all the time and I look at scads and scads and scads and oodles of data, and it convinces me over the period of time looking at it that the evidence is resilient, that the world is turning and round, and I pay attention to many accepted laws of physics. Some I accept, some I don't. It's an electromagnetic universe, not a gravity-only universe. I pick my arguments where the information and the data leads, but you cannot rush on your way to a final judgment, like the Earth is flat or injecting people with mercury and thimerosal is safe. Flat earthers and pro-vaccine people have a lot in common. They have everything, in fact, in common. They need very little evidence and a lot of emotion to stick to their points. Maybe they should get together, be the flat earth pro-vaccine camp. Maybe then we don't understand who they all are. See, I just subtly called them a name, and so they're angry. Now, if we get away from the name calling and I talk about the idiots and jackasses that who come and tell me that there are water-powered cars that will save us from oil running lower. See, you remember that I call them names, and they're down dairy, they're water-powered cars. And these people will send me, and I'm not talking about the nice people, I'm talking about the ones who don't do the research after I ask them to do the research. There are no water-powered cars. There are hydrogen-powered cars. And you get the hydrogen out of the water by putting a strong electrical zap in it. You generate the electricity by boiling the water. It spins a paddle. It hits the donkey that pulls a wire that makes the electricity. Something like that. Nobody knows how to debate. If you really weren't interested in winning the debate, but interested in actually having a debate, the internet would be a very quiet place, and there would be no comments on YouTube. Most of the stuff that comes out in favor of vaccines, in favor of flat Earth, in favor of the current AIDS, cancer, whatever paradigms, is mostly a lot of emotion and a little bit of math, just back of the envelope bullshit that's supposed to cover all the differences. I suggest that you define your terms very carefully before you get into a debate, because it's not a debate, it's an argument. You're just hashing it out and going nowhere on Facebook. Don't do it. Ask them to define their terms. Ask them to define the specific case that they're talking about. Don't let them budge. Hold to it. If they won't concede after you've presented your information and you consider your information resilient and meaningful, the debate is over and you won. You don't get anything for it, because the military-industrial petrol complex controls everything. And on that note, have a great night. My name's Liam Sheff. This is American Heretic. A couple dollars in the PayPal helps this debate keep going. If you go on the internet with a mind to debate something like flat Earth or vaccines, you'll quickly find that nobody knows how to debate anything on the internet. I'd like to just give you a few tips, if I can, in this short video. My name is Liam Sheff. My books are Official Stories, Truth About Love. This is American Heretic. PayPal links to the side and below. If you're going to debate, you have to propose an initial argument. You have to have a proposition. Proposition: vaccines are safe and effective. You then have to have supporting data for that. You present that data. You then have to be willing to hear an argument that contradicts that data. So contravening contrary data. So somebody has to say vaccines are neither safe nor effective. You have to listen to that. You can make a rebuttal. They make a rebuttal. At some point, you're going to have to concede if they've overwhelmed some of your, pro statements. If you're not willing to concede, then you're not debating. You're arguing, or you're fighting. Fighting is a lot different than either argument or debate. And the internet is right now full of fighting. It's exhausting, and I watch a lot of people get sucked into it. And they often write me and say, hey, I'm stuck in this debate. And I look at it and I say, you already won. They've changed the subject 80 times. But your initial point is long gone. Let's say that you enter a debate and you say something like, here's one. HIV is not the cause of AIDS. Well, that's a very big matzo ball of a statement, to put it that way. It's a very, very big, gargantuan statement, and it's shocking. You say, well, how am I supposed to prove that? How am I supposed to disprove it? I mean, everybody knows that HIV causes AIDS. Okay, let's define our terms step by step. If you are going to tell somebody that they're HIV positive and that they're going to get AIDS, you have to tell them first that you have to give them a test to tell them that they're HIV positive, right? So that would seem to be the entry point. Because if you can't tell somebody based on something resilient, repeatable, standardized, well understood, well typified, and reproducible, that they are in fact a particular thing, then you can't go to statement B. You can't say that the cooties virus causes cooties, or that that's good enough. The cooties virus causes cooties. You can't say that unless you have a cooties test. So let's say that we're going to then, instead of saying, does HIV cause AIDS, we're going to say, how good is the HIV test? do HIV tests, in fact, test for HIV. Now we're getting somewhere. We're defining our terms. We're refining the argument. We're making it something that we can actually demonstrate. It's not saying something like the Earth is flat. I know it because you're stupid and this video makes it look like the Earth is flat. That's an argument from insult and ad hominem. It's a kind of a non sequitur. It's an argument without enough information. So the Earth looks flat in this video has not been tested or contradicted. You're not testing it from a variety of angles. So you have the HIV argument. Somebody comes at you with a huge statement like vaccines are safe and effective. You have to wait. Are we going to debate? We have to define our terms. It's very important that we define our terms. What do you mean by a vaccine? Oh, shit, we have to define our terms. HIV causes AIDS. We have to define what we mean. What is AIDS? What is HIV? How do you define somebody being HIV positive? How do you define somebody being HPV positive? How do you define HPV causing cervical cancer? You have to define all of these terms. If you're in a fight with somebody online and they tell you that you are crazy and a liar, they're not debating you. They're insulting you. And you don't have to talk to them anymore. You don't get anything for it. There's no great internet database of, you know, wins and lose and losses. There's just a lot of time wasting. I mean, most of the stuff that goes on is people desperately trying to convince other people that their children have been hurt by deadly chemicals, and that's the only reason they're so-called debating, because they're hurt. Their hearts have been broken, and their children are damaged, and they're trying to get some attention for it that is meaningful. But they're not allowed a seat in a public forum like a phony news program like Democracy Now, or a phony news program like any other news program, or a phony information site like Huffington Post. They're not actually allowed space to present their argument. So they go and they debate people that they don't know online. I suspect a lot of these people are operatives. I truly suspect a lot of the people who have time to go and make counter arguments to critical arguments. Follow what I said there. The people who have time to squash critical arguments are paid opposition, most likely. Because, you know, and by paid, they may be PhD students, they may have been set by a professor to go have some fun with some people online, they may be PhDs who simply enjoy doing it because it satisfies their ego to beat up on people who don't have PhDs. They may be small-minded absolutists who are fighting for something that you don't understand, or, very likely, there may be a group of, you know, highly gifted sociopaths paid by government proxy agencies who go into sub-basements with 15 or 20 screens on at one time, playing 15 or 20 roles, interacting with you online and winding you up. Don't discount that as a possibility. Don't. There are people who are gifted enough and sociopathic enough to do just that. So if you end up in a debate and you're not getting anywhere, pause and say, can we define our terms? Can we define our terms? What is it that you are seeking? You know, what is your argument? That vaccines are safe and effective? What would you take as contraindicating evidence? What would you do that as contrary evidence to that, contravening evidence? How would you, at what point would you allow yourself to be considered sufficiently challenged that you would call yourself having been falsified, to use that terminology? At which point do you give up the ghost and say, I cannot absolutely hold on to this point anymore? If you're fighting with somebody and they're pretending to be diplomatic and you get a sense that they're so agenda-driven that they won't listen, put it to them and say, can we define what we're actually debating here? Just for a moment, can we define a specific point? Is it that thimerosal is not dangerous? Can we just define that? Because if we can do that, if we can just talk about whether thimerosal or mercury has ever been dangerous, or should we debate whether it's ever been in a vaccine? You have to ask, what exactly are we talking about? There are people who will wind you up. They will change the topic and change the topic and change the topic. And you, being inexperienced in this, will think that this is what a debate is. It's not. That's just a game of cat and mouse, and you're the mouse. They can do this all day long. They just keep putting out crumbs and you chase them like a little cat across the floor. Well, I said you were the mouse. But anyway, now you're a dog or a cat. You're a rodent chasing a shiny object. Oh, do rodents chase shiny objects? I'm mixing my metaphors, and they'll do that to you too. I think that you get the point of this. I don't need to belabor it. If you go online to debate, define your terms. If you feel like you're being pushed around, stop and say, here is what I think I'm debating with you. I don't know you. So, would you kindly please tell me what you think you're debating with me? If they're not able to do that, well, you've just discovered somebody that you can flick away. You don't have to waste your time anymore. And that's worth something. It's worth a lot. It took me years to figure that out, by the way. So, my name's Liam Sheff. My books are Official Stories and the Truth About Love. This is American Heretic. Don't waste your time in useless online debates. Define your terms, figure out what they are, and know when it's time to concede an argument, and do it with grace. My name's Liam Sheff. This is American Heretic, funded by you. My book is Official Stories, 10 chapters, 11 topics, American history, CIA, JFK, 9/11. We needed the oil. We needed to be in the oil states. Vaccination, not a science. HIV, not a science. Big Bang, not a science. Plate tectonics, not a science. Shakespeare, not history. It's all there for you to think about. I'm presenting you counter-arguments. Counter-arguments to the historical fabrications that you've been fed. Scratch beneath the scratching beneath the cervix is a very different story for another time. Scratch beneath the surface and you'll find 1,000 what were mainstream stories that get buried beneath the headlines. So that's what Official Stories is. Scratching beneath the cervix, I don't recommend scratching, go very gently, is something that I talk about when I talk about sex, because we are not a very monogamous species. I want to talk about, not biologically, not historically, not archaeologically, anthropologically, not in our inheritance, not in our worldview, not even healthily are we a very monogamous species. We'll talk about that a little. I want to talk about what the future really looks like. I'll wind some sex talk into that. The future does not look like a gleaming, magical city of Oz on the hill. A kind of city of today, but without all the noise, hover cars instead of internal combustion engines, lovely clean mass transit going in cylinder, going in glass tubes, plexiglass tubes going around the city, skyscrapers with food growing in them at every level. I don't think so. I think the city becomes an abandoned husk. I think that the world looks Mad Max-y in parts, but not for very long, because you're not going to be fighting for gas for long. You know who's going to own the gas? The military-industrial complex and the 1% who pays them and who they guard. The rest of us will live outside the castle wall. So what does the future look like? It looks like what the present really is beneath the surface. If we take away the glossy surface and the flood of oil that coats our daily lives, we pull back all of the machinery that brings us our food, and food is immediately relocalized. We are immediately relocalizing the production of food, or we're dying. And mass death is something that will be happening this century, I predict. Save magical Deus Ex Machina intervention, and that's only for the books, that's only for the Greek plays. We don't get that in real life. Save all of that gobbledygook that you get in fiction, because we can't stand to have the hero die. In real life, a lot of people in starvation scenarios die. And people who don't have enough energy in their society, and that energy is the plow horse, the peasant to make the land work, die. Just go to Maoist Russia, go to Maoist China, in Stalinist Russia. You see tens of millions of people dying in short order because they didn't have enough energy in the land or from the sun or from the floodplain or the river to make the energy that they all needed to live. And the people managing that burgeoning population mismanaged it, because you cannot manage large populations from the top down. One of the things that's going to happen in America, and is happening now in Europe, it'll happen all over China, is decentralization. Now, we've gone through a centralization process, and that centralization process doesn't have anything to do with us, glomming on to Thomas Paine or the Rights of Man or Thomas Jefferson or his adversary, Hamilton,
Alexander Hamilton. It's none of these personalities. You know, libertarians always believe in personality politics. I think, I don't know if Stefan Molyneux believes in personality politics, but Arianna Huffman, you know, personality politics. We've got to vote this way, we've got to vote that way, or at least we have to vote liberal, which is represented by these people. That's all a myth. Personalities only represent energetic movements. If there's enough energy in the land, if there's enough energy in the people, if there's enough sunlight, enough rain, enough floodplain from the river, enough fertility, then you feed people and politics become pretty liberal. And if things had been conservative, you know, because you had come from a more difficult time and they're getting more abundant, then politics shift. And you seem to embody that shift in a couple of people who say, we can shift now. But you can't shift unless you have the energy to do it. That point is, and I know that that coin just hit the bottom of your brass, your spittoon over there. Ka-ping! We know that on Collective Evolution and Huffington Post, everybody believes that we can just shift. Oh, we can just shift. No, you can't. If you don't have the energy in your society at a thermodynamic level, at an energetic level of food and abundant fuel, you're not going to have a shift in the direction of more freedom. So the personalities that come along that end up being favored will favor a downshift into conservatism. People think that Trump is a problem or is, you know, something that you have to think about. Trump represents the knowledge that we're more poor than we used to be. We're more poor than we were in the 90s and even the 80s. We don't have the essentially free Saudi oil that we used to have. It's gone. We're paying a lot more for worse quality product. People in the oil business know this, and they're desperately trying to sell us on oil that's buried 3 miles beneath the ocean. We'll never get it. We'll never get it. The internet's full of, you know, Peter Pan fans. I do believe in fairies. I do believe in fairies. I do believe in free energy. I do believe in water cars. Okay, whatever. You can believe anything you want. In the Middle Ages, they believed Jesus was coming back and was going to save us all. They believed in every incarnation of monster and fairy. And you have, you know, friends and ex-friends of mine, people whose shows I've been on regularly and stopped going on because they just can't stop themselves from believing in magically refilling oil fields or in cars that run on hope. You know, we totally ignore the thermodynamics of the 20th century at our peril. Politics isn't going to change because we have some hopeful candidate running. You can run anybody you want, but unless they represent the energetic system behind the political system, they're not going to get elected. The military-industrial complex is always the wisest measure of what's real, because they have to have the most energy first. So they're aware, the military-industrial complex is long aware that we're running low and have run low on all the cheap oil. So they're very busy holding on to the expensive oil, which is overseas. If it becomes necessary to put a gun to people's head to drill offshore, if it's even worth it, that'll happen, you know, or it'll just go through some rotten vote and people will protest, and the protest will go on Facebook, and the CIA will invade and, you know, put its proxy super genius Asperger people into the Facebook, and they'll fuck with all the activists who are just earnest and naive and actually think that they can make a difference by arguing something on Facebook. Sorry, hold on. Come on, this thing is just totally infested. I mean, this is a way that we spin our wheels. I use it, but it's a way that we spin our wheels to talk to people who already agree with us. If you're out there actually debating people on Facebook, it's your own time you're wasting. You're not going to change anybody's mind. Those of us who go there just for the solace of hearing our own thoughts back to us from people who we agree with, because we are a tribal animal. And we do want to know who our group is. That's not valueless. Actually, that's probably the most valuable thing we can do. If we're talking about doing something meaningful, if you're talking about holding vigils for bills that already are defeated or something, I don't know, good luck. I know. It's meaningful for you in your heart, but you better be growing food. The entire political system of the world, and this is something, again, you know, geniuses. Stefan Molyneux is a genius. Arianna Huffington's incredibly bright, but they don't seem to understand that our entire society lives on Monsanto land. And if they do, somebody write me and show me their video where they understand it, and I'll apologize. Guys who are very, very, very bright and earnest, Del Bigtree, Andy Wakefield, going out there fighting the vaccine war, don't seem to they don't give any indication of understanding that we're actually living in a collapsing society. So I wish them luck with their film, and yeah, I'm totally against forced vaccination. We should have a choice, and I'm glad for every inroad they make, but they misunderstand that we're in a collapsing society because our energy structure is diminishing. Nobody seems to get it. My friend Robert Scott Bell is one of the only guys, Mike Adams of Natural News, two guys who get it. They understand we're living in a collapsing society because of our energy that we use to fund everything that we do, from the military-industrial complex to the petro-agricultural complex to the media complex, is all collapsing. It's all going to collapse. All that can happen now is that we get better propaganda that steers us toward that, you know, future green core where we go and live at barracks at the Walmart Monsanto village, work the genetically modified foods, we work the black seam, we start digging for more coal because some study comes out saying it's actually less polluting than we thought and we need it. The fact is we're going to need it just to make electricity locally. We realize that even when solar gets cheaper, its capacity to generate electricity is pretty low, and we need it, but it's pretty low, and these things have to be replaced a lot faster than we thought, and the scale up of industry to make all of these things at the rate that we now use them just isn't possible. So, you know, we're going to have to just shoot lower on the energetic food chain in terms of where we live. Human species doesn't like to know that it's in for a change. It's never just embraced change. You know, it didn't see the Ice Age coming, it didn't see the plagues coming, it just died. The human species died back to very small numbers of parts in parts of memorable human history, of recorded human history, or at least history that's recorded in the bones and rocks and the remains. Our future looks a lot like our past. Our future looks a lot like medieval towns, hamlets, and villages, with a couple of electrical windmills, with an old power generating plant that we keep up with the retained knowledge of a very few people, and that one day goes offline. I don't know what to tell you. I mean, why do you think that we're owed a perpetual late 20th century? It's a blip. I have no confidence in the idea that this late 20th century is going to survive forever and ever and ever. It barely happened. It's an eyelash on a dinosaur. I know it's the tiniest fleck of skin on the biggest giant. It's just here and gone. And we're back to being the same old lumbering stupid beasts that we ever were. Tool making, clever, marshaling our resources through fear and ritual, aligning government not on principle but on totem and taboo. Always totem and taboo. We're always creating the taboo, and the taboo is always based on a poorly remembered energy crisis. You know, the reason we have taboos is because of something that happened in the past that just didn't work where we were living. It's been said that if you accumulated all of the taboos from every area on Earth together, there would be human beings could do nothing. But if you compared the taboos in one area to another, they're entirely the taboo in one area is the prescribed behavior in another. It depends on the energy structure. And I said I'd talk a little about sex. I got a minute. Go around the world and figure out, from energy structure to energy structure, go to the South Sea Islands where the rain falls, the food drops from the trees, fish are jumping, you grow roots and tubers, you can, catch pigs all day long and, eat to your heart's content. And there's no limitation on sex, there's no concept of some sort of lifelong monogamy. Sex starts when people want to have sex in their teens and they have it their whole lives long, and you're not have this shame and guilt culture about it because they had enough food. So they didn't have to worry about, managing property. You then begin to understand something as impenetrable and mysterious as sex. People, when they come of age, start having sex, and there are not all kinds of rules about it. In fact, if you look at Captain Cook and his voyages, and I'll do this on another show, but I just wanted to talk a little, because I said I was going to. You look at Captain Cook and his voyages, his sailors got off in Polynesia, they didn't have the British reserve. Well, the Britons had to deal with a very different energetic structure. They had the European energy structure of agriculture, of famine, of dearth, of going without, of plague. And so they had great fear, and they had to marshal their resources very tightly and manage them, and they had to manage the women so they could manage the property. Down there in the South Sea Islands, you got you know, very, very good-looking young women saying, yeah, okay, we can have sex. And now you understand the energetic difference about how we... Yeah, I'm going to save this for the next episode. I am. I'm going to save... We're going to continue this talk in the next episode because I can't round the corner with it. Sex, like all things in a society, like technology, like ritual, like fear, are all based in energy. And the most important idea that I can give you is to look at the future as... You can predict the future based on how much energy we have. And you can see who's going to lapse back into a hard, cataclysmic, Armageddon... wanting, fearing Jesus land, or a Muhammad land, an Allah land, and who's going to be down there in the South Pacific going, yeah, we don't have too much to worry about, do what you want, enjoy yourself, you know, we raise the children in groups, so it doesn't matter if you get pregnant when you're 17, because it's a kid for the group to raise, and that builds our tribe, and we're happy about that, because we got enough food, and the gods are good. And you can just see the difference in the tribal mindset from plenty of energy to a paucity of energy. Nobody gets it. I'm the only one I know who talks about this, except for some of the peak oil guys, and they don't really go back into history very far. So here I am, Liam Sheff, American Heretic. A couple dollars in the PayPal keeps these messages of interesting information coming your way.